Welcome to episode 126 of the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast slash lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, approximately. Sometimes it's an hour and 20 minutes later than that. Every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. We encourage anyone and everyone listening to join us and participate on the podcast. Check out http://www.linuxlugcast.com for the server details. Should you have any questions, comments, or topics you would like us to discuss and are unable to join us during the live show, you can send us an email at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. Or check out our MeWe community at https://mewe.com/join/linuxlugcast. Or check us out on the IRC Freenode server /linuxlugcast. I am your host for tonight, 5150. On the air with me this evening, our Honky Magoo.
Evening, folks. Yeah, I forgot to mention the fact that I kind of shrunk down the intro by a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you found out that, you know, /join/linuxlugcast will work for me. We rather than that whole alphabet soup that we had in there, so that'll make it easier for people to find us. Unfortunately, we don't have enough traffic really back and forth on Linux Lugcast for MeWe to put, you know, for us to be searchable. Also we have Joe.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
And Net Miner.
Hello, friend.
Okay, we have a couple feedbacks, and I do have the link there. To our MeWe group with all the alphabet soup in there. If you want to cut and paste that in your browser, and we had feedback I saw this week from Crean Matthews again, and I think from Danny Meeks. It comes up when I go to our group. It looks like it's originally addressed to Tilts and maybe CC to us or something. But I think Danny was meaning to throw it in with our stuff, so we'll talk about it. And Crean, Danny, I hope you guys know that, like everybody else, you are certainly welcome to fire up a Mumble client and encouraged to join us live on the podcast. Crean says, and again, I think he's copying stuff from his blog, which is fine. It's, you know, great to have a topic to talk about. It says, hello, colleagues. I leave a video tutorial with their respective English translations. This is very didactic, if I'm pronouncing that right. It's simple, short, and accurate. To learn how to create a bootable USB memory in Linux. Where they want to try a Linux distribution without installing it on their machine or installing it, you can do it with a bootable USB memory. You should only choose the distribution of Linux that you prefer. So what he's talking about, rather than, you know, burning an install CD or creating an install image to a thumb drive, this will give you an image that I assume is well, you could continue it off of the USB multiple times. In other words, it would be you would be able to change things and come back, and those changes would be there. And I'm trying to think of the better word for that, but it'd be just like rather than running a static install, and then you can play with the install And depending on, you know, some distributions, you have an install CD, and the only thing you can do is install. Usually won't just go install without you clicking on something. But some distributions will have an install image and a image you can play around with. Most of them, it's one and the same, that you can go in an image and run the image, and then should you decide to install it, there's an install button on the desktop. But this would be one that would be dynamic is the word that I'm was looking for. So in other words, you could run this, and in fact you could, you know, shut down the computer, pull the drive out, you know, take it to work with you and boot from that on your work computer, and be looking at the distribution that you've already gone in, modified, added software to. So I think we all knew we could do that, and if we were to do that, I definitely would have to, unless there was a pre-prepared image like that, I would definitely have to do some consulting on the internet, you know, and look up how exactly to go about it. So Korean has linked to a YouTube video that goes step by step and tells you how to do it, and I guess with any distribution.
I think you're talking about a persistent USB image.
Thank you, Netminer. That's a much better description than I had, the persistent.
I was going to say perpetual, but you're right, persistent. That's the right one. I know there's a couple of Linux distributions that are based on just that concept of installing onto something like a USB drive and are persistent. I want to say there was one from that's based on Slackware that I tried before. I'm going to have to look it up.
Tails is made to run live.
Right. Another thing, diagnostics, that's handy to run, that you could, you know, especially perhaps maybe if you have a Windows cleaning tool, I think you can get, I'm trying to think of the one everybody uses,
PC cleaner?
No, Malwarebytes. I think you can get and PC Cleaner would be another good one. I'm pretty sure you can get Malwarebytes to run under Wine. Not that there aren't, native Linux tools that also go clean your hard drive. And, that's something I probably should have set up and don't. And just keep that on my keyring, you know. So, I mean, Malwarebytes really does pretty good, even if you download it on an infected machine and run it. But, you know, to be completely sure, if you want to be absolutely sure nothing in the background was messing around with you, then the only way to do that would be to, you know, to be able to boot to a clean image or, with the maintenance tools installed. So that would be one really good real world example of why you might want to create a persistent image and carry it around on a USB device.
On a side note, I think Puppy Linux is also persistent, but the one I was thinking of was called Slax, and I just went to the website, and apparently Slax is now based on Debian as opposed to Slackware.
And this was some of my earliest, introduction to Linux, because there were a couple of images out there that were, set up as, you know, pretty much Windows repair images rather than something that you would actually run as a operating system from bare metal.
Nopix.
Well, actually, Nopix was Men's Persistent Image, but Avis something, there was a couple of them out there that were really not intended as a running Linux image, but as a repair tool for Windows.
Well, you talked about Tails. The thing about Tails and LPS, which is a government Linux, is they're specifically not persistent.
Right.
Although
they're not supposed to have persistent memory on them. They're supposed to be a specific image, load it, and then use it, and it restores itself back to factory defaults afterwards.
Right. That's, you know, saying something.
Although LPS, I believe, may have the option of storing to a separate USB stick.
And a persistent image would probably be the easiest way to get something like Bitdefender or, well, that's more of an antivirus. I mean, you get your own standalone Bitdefender disk. Malwarebytes, something like that. I'm sure probably if you're clever enough, you could set up a non-persistent Unix with, you know, Malwarebytes and, you know, installed a custom setup. And that way you wouldn't have to worry about being corrupted.
Right. Every time you start talking about Malwarebytes on a disk, I just start thinking about app images.
Well, actually, you're also talking about System Rescue CD.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, really great, dedicated antivirus and various other tools dedicated on an image or a CD. But the thing is, every time I've run one of those, like Kaspersky or something like that, it takes, you know, I get to the client and it's like, you know, either, you know, I can set this thing up and leave, or, you know, you can send it home with me, but it's going to take 3.5 hours to run and we're just going to be sitting there looking at it.
Well, from my experience with a lot of things depend on the speed of your drive. I found running the portable app suite, which is not exactly the same thing, off of USB 3 when natively supported, it was quite responsive. If you're running stuff off of USB 2, it can be pretty slow.
Well, I'm talking stuff you know that's just on a boot CD-ROM, and I think once it's going, it's probably got everything loaded into memory. It's just for some reason, Malwarebytes seems to be a lot more efficient and nearly as effective as, you know, running one of those boot to the CD and then scan everything. I don't know why it's so much faster, but it does seem, you know, always has been for me. I mean, Malwarebytes, I can say, yeah, we can, you know, this will be done in 20, 40 minutes, you know, long enough to, you know, not make it worth going anywhere or whatever, you know, that everything else is 3 hours. But if I really want to be sure, you know, yeah, I throw everything in the toolkit at it, you know, and say, you know, let's do several different tools, and make sure. Though on Windows, I always tell the customer I make no guarantees to be absolutely certain, because there's always going to be somebody clever enough to come up with something that's a step ahead of everybody else. But, you know, for most things, you know, you run the stuff and the symptoms go away and the client is usually satisfied with that.
Well, also, I think you're running into the Swiss Army knife problem.
Too many tools altogether?
Also, the Syscom Rescue CD or what have you not only has too many tools, but everything is going to be configured to run on the lowest common denominator system. So if you're looking at a system that is designed to run in 1 gigabyte on anything, you're looking at a different system than something that has a single tool that just loads itself and does what it does.
I'd imagine if you're going to be using just that one tool or whatever, then you could probably strip that thing down, that image down, if you need to, especially if it's a persistent system.
Well, I'm just saying that if you get system CD, rescue CD off of whatever, or NOPIX or what have you, as a ISO image, it is going to be configured for a regular... It's going to be configured for...
It's going to be generic as opposed to specific, so it might lose some functionality.
Well, in other words, you're saying rather than it being geared expandable, you know, oh, yeah, this guy's got 16 meg RAM on the system, let's use all that. It's the image is... Let's run, see if we can run it in 512 meg.
Yeah, something that's working in, that's trying to get the minimum system requirements, 32-bit, 40, or 64-bit, whatever, or even minimum 32. Since I've got a worst-case 64-bit machine, I think it's 2 gig RAM and a single core. If everything is designed to run on that, it will run like shit on anything that's got some real performance.
And the other thing I've never set up, always wanted to do, is set up all these images on Pixie Boot, since most of your modern machines will Pixie Boot, you know, so I could just bring it home, connect it to my network, and run everything that way rather than having to swap disks in and out. We've got a lot to cover tonight. Do we want to jump to the next topic?
Sure.
And I would really like to look at this and kick this around, but again, probably good enough right now for just the link. Crean continues, all companies, including how large or small, run on their data. Considering the financial and business cost of losing all the data you need to run your business, there's not a business today, ranging from the smallest sole proprietorship to the largest global corporation, that could survive the cost of all or even a large loss of all or even a large fraction of its data. Your place of business can be rebuilt using insurance, but your data can never be rebuilt. And he's put in a link to Andromeda Computer, talking about using rsync to back up your Linux system. I think probably serve us better if maybe wait till next time. And I will make sure I read through that article front and back, and be in a place where I can discuss it intelligently rather than trying to do it on the fly.
Well, I know that there seem to be some damn good rsync front ends, as well as applications which use rsync in the background. I make the distinction because, like the Polo File Manager has an rsync component in it. But I think there are some things that that give you a GUI for rsync and some setup stuff that helps a lot when I was looking at it. Also, Pixie. I could see the Atomic Pi being a genuinely great Pixie server.
Yeah, well, you're right, because I don't think you can actually do it with I think there's some way you can do it with ARM, but you're right. It'd probably be more than worth it, no more than they cost, to use that as Atomic Pi as a dedicated Pixie server if you were going to do that. And there's another, Crane also links another Andromeda article, how to use advanced rsync for large Linux backups. But yeah, I think you're right, Netminder. I would guess 90% or more of the GUI backup solutions use rsync on the back end.
Well, I'm just saying some of them would add, some of them have a plugin or connection to rsync on your file managers, and some of them are just dedicated rsync shells.
Oh, and I wanted to thank you for bringing up Netminder, for bringing up Apollo on the last show. I should be gone more often, and because there are two or three things in that show that I wasn't aware of that you guys brought in. I found very interesting. Now, I am probably stubborn enough that I am not going to rush to something that is, pay for this extra and pay for that extra, but definitely I think it's worth taking a look at.
Yeah, well, that is the, to go from the gaming model, it's a freemium game, file manager.
Right, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just cheap, and, I did not always contribute as much to, the financially to the projects I take advantage of. I do to some media, some content creators I contribute to, but it's not that often that I really pay for the software that I'm using where I should be. I have to admit to that, but definitely I find the idea of Apollo intriguing.
Well, I'm going to be looking at it, and I'm also going to be looking at, I've got multiple machines, and I think once you unlock it, you can unlock it for your key is for as many installs as you like.
Oh, well, that's even better yet, because I tend to get on something. I mean, I use Thunar right now, and I intend to get on something I like and run with it on everything, and be annoyed if I can't find it in the distro. It's one of the things I didn't. Well, one of the knocks I had against Solus, it wasn't a deal breaker, but Thunar was not in the repository, and of course they have the theory. Why duplicate things? We have something we think is, serves the same purpose. So why would we throw every file manager in there? Not necessarily something I completely agreed with if it's not the file manager I prefer, but that wasn't why I've quit using Solus, and I wouldn't discourage anybody from playing with Solus, or use it as a daily driver. I just, a couple times I got bit, and I just had probably something I did, something I installed, but had an update, came back from an update, and then the machine didn't work. And, once was okay, twice was no, let's find something that's, at least more comparable with my capabilities, if not everybody else's. I'm sure it was entirely my fault.
No, I must say, that I don't know if a Polo key will work on every installation in your facility. I don't know if it's, but I think it probably is branding so that differentiates supporters from non-supporters. I'm not sure whether it will work on multiple installs. I would inquire at the Polo support site to see how their keys work.
Okay, now you brought up one thing. Were you able to install that from repos, or was this something you had to download from GitHub?
I believe it's a GitHub thing. I've looked at it, and the fact that Star Sync in the background caused me to bounce off to some pure rsync shells and other things. I haven't gone into it in detail, but Polo and Sublime Text are maybe the couple of applications that I'd actually pay for, although I don't know much about Sublime Text itself, but I do a lot of text work, so I may look into them. Also, I would have to figure out a payment method, perhaps a prepaid credit card just for such limited applications.
Okay. Yeah, good luck with that. I have tried for years to do that. There was, I think, probably because they don't have enough credit card numbers out there. There was one credit card for a while that did a thing where, yeah, we'll put, you know, create this dummy one-time credit card number, and you can put $50 on it or whatever. And, you know, if it's somebody you're not sure about, then it'll, you know, the maximum they could get out of your account is that $50 that you put on it. And, you know, I'm betting it's like IP addresses and telephone numbers that they don't have enough numbers to actually do that.
Well, the deal is that when you go down to a CVS or even a Staples or whatnot, you can buy a prepaid credit card, just like a prepaid phone card, and that would only be valid for the amount on the card.
Yeah, but I've tried that. You know, I bought one of those at Walmart, and the first thing it wants to do is connect it to my regular card.
Yes. So that's definitely not what you want.
Yeah, it's like, man, I gave you $20 when I bought the card. You know, that's all I want on the card. I don't want it connected to me. You know, for theoretical purposes. You know, Joe, were you the one who was on here said you'd gotten bit by Alibaba before?
Well, not just Alibaba, but yeah, I have in the past gotten bit by Alibaba, trying to steal my credit card number, adding extra charges. And one time it was, I think, $1,100 that they were trying to take from my account, and it was listed as mesothelioma donation. And then one time it was a series of $75 gift cards for the iTunes store. And yeah, but that was several years ago.
Yeah, see, I've ordered stuff off Alibaba before you had mentioned that, and never had a problem. I think a lot of people have, but yeah, there are things out there I would prefer to. Well, shoot, probably ought to put every charge behind a firewall, because you know where I was just at the other week, and we're getting to eventually the. you know, the Westin in Detroit, that's under the whole Marriott umbrella, where, you know, where they had a big data breach and a bunch of charge, you know, false charges and people having to change their credit cards and stuff last year. So it's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be some little sketchy foreign company.
Hell, I think I was one of the ones that was bit by I think Home Depot has been breached that way. Target was breached that way. I mean, you know, I haven't heard of Walmart being attacked that way, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay, well, let's go on to what Danny posted. And he said he never thought he'd see the day that you could download Arch Linux from the Windows Store. And of course, this is the command line Linux component of the, Windows 10 Pro. Of course, you can run an X server on it and then run about any Linux software from within the Arch in Windows. You guys were discussing that, Joe, on the last Tilts, but there's just a link to where you can install Arch on top of Windows. And he just thought that Danny thought, you know, kind of really made it or, you know, major milestone. You can put Arch inside of Windows now.
Well, the thing that I'm wondering about is all I have seen on the Windows subsystem for Linux is the command line system. I haven't, nobody has really said anything about running an X server on it.
Apparently you can't run just, you know, X like we think of as in Windows, but there are third-party X servers. At least that's what they were saying on Tilts last week, that are free to download and you can run. And of course, it's not like you get a desktop, I think, inside Windows, but it's like, you know, you go on the command line and run OpenOffice right from the command line.
Yeah, and I don't remember the discussion about Arch specifically, but they were talking about an actual Linux kernel being available on Windows now.
Right, but that isn't, I don't think they're replacing the Windows kernel with the...
No, but with the next generation of Windows subsystem on Linux, it's going to be an actual Linux kernel instead of something specifically designed just for Windows.
Okay, so at this point, it's been more of an emulation than the actual kernel.
Right, and now it's going to be more like a VM.
Well, I guess we're eventually getting there until they eventually give up and say they've been wrong for all these years. And
well, they've already kind of started doing that with, because I know some people are talking about using the Chrome version of Edge in some of the podcasts that I listen to. So it kind of feels like they're shifting more towards the open source and then just offering services or enhancements on top of. So just the way they're going, I wouldn't be surprised if in 5 or 10 years that's all it was.
Actually, what somebody has mentioned is they're doing something rather like Android or Mac OS X, where eventually you'll have a Linux kernel with a proprietary wrapper on the outside.
Yeah,
right. That's kind of what they were hinting at on Telx, is, you know, eventually they may give up and abandon their kernel and stick something open source in there. I wouldn't want to hold my breath for that, but...
Well, if you look at Darwin, which is the Mac OS basis for Mac OS X, I mean, it is the... what is it? Mach basis for Mac OS X. that's what you're running into.
Well, that's what, you know, for a while they were discussing on Tilts last week. You know, could you run OS 10 on ARM? You know, it is, you know, Apple's been kind of fickle on processors. They started with you know, 68K processors, and then they went to PowerPC, and now they're on Intel. So, I mean, it's obvious the company is kind of processor agnostic, and with more powerful ARM processors, you know, will they abandon IBM, or rather Intel, and say, hey, we could make an efficient, cheaper PC on an ARM processor, because, you know, they're running BSD at the core, which is no less efficient than Linux would be. It'd probably be whether they could shove Darwin on top of ARM,
which is very ironic, because ARM and the PPC, which they left after, are sort of cousins.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
Well, yeah. Basically, they went from Motorola 68XXX to PowerPC chips, and when they ran out of steam, they went to 8x86, and going to an ARM-based Mac OS X would be rather like going back to the original OS X under PPC. By the way, PPC is also the chip that runs IBM Z systems.
Right, I knew IBM, a lot of their stuff was still on PPCs.
Well, it's under PPC 370XXX emulation.
Okay, I'm going to take this point and jump into show topics. And I've got quite a few here. I'm sorry, guys. It's going to probably be a fairly long show. If we want to, you know, maybe stop it at one point and continue stuff on next time. Completely understand, but first I'll start, and I was going to kind of spread this out, but I'll try to consolidate all this really quick. My travel woes, and this was on me, but the day I was going to leave, I had something I didn't anticipate and should have come up, so I missed the flight out. Didn't reschedule the flight till the next day, and the earliest I could get there was about 11 o'clock in the morning, so I missed a full day of PenguinCon, and also, I didn't realize at the time, not only did I sacrifice, but cost my flight out. On the way home, I found out that, no, I couldn't get the flight back that I had. I actually rescheduled the exact same flight, just paying full price, you know, because they'd already sold my ticket. So, you know, everything I paid for ahead of time just, you know, went in the trash. And so I sort of paid full price going out and coming back. So that wasn't any fun. Got to the airport in Detroit. And they'd moved the pickup point for ride sharing, which didn't bother me. At least they were labeling it better. Last time, you know, always before, always wound up in the wrong place. I mean, you get off this elevator and you go right or left, you know, in the parking garage, I'm always going on, winding up in the wrong place, because this, you know, elevator sort of divide that area of the parking garage, and it's not very well marked. This time it really was well marked, but it's up on the fourth floor and of the parking garage, very well marked. This is the pickup area for ride share. So get the Uber app, you know, and a person's a few minutes out and then they call me. And of course they're wanting to do this because it's, you know, it's like a four, it's not that long, but it's like a 40 minute or $40 Uber. Some reason it's cheaper on the way back. I don't understand that. Or at least was this time. But they were really willing to make wanting to make the sale, and I think this person was behind the times, this whole moving to new places. And, no, I can't pick you up there. We're not allowed to pick you up there. We're only allowed to go this one place. And I said, I don't think it's that, you know, I don't think it's there anymore. I think, you know, I am standing under a sign that says, this is pickup place for ride sharing. They said, no, I can't, I'm not allowed to go there by the company. I have to pick you up here. And it's all right. So go back downstairs. And of course, none of this is labeled. And I mean, literally, it's an hour back and forth on the phone. And her saying, you know, why aren't you here? And I said, well, you know, because it's the other place. And, you know, none of these places down here are marked for that anymore. And where are you? I'm in this area and I'm on this area. And finally, it was go back and I'll pick you up in the, you know, your family picks you up area, which they aren't supposed to go to. But it's one place we both could agree on where it was. So got picked up, you know, finally got to the hotel. But I mean, probably, you know, I try to be a nice guy, work with people. I probably just hung up, either called Lyft or did another Uber. Somebody knew where they were supposed to be. Because I could hear her in the background. She was where she thought she was supposed to be. And somebody yelling at you, no, you can't pick up people here. You need to go to the other place. And still she kept insisting, well, this is the place where the company says I have to be. And, you know, when obviously that was incorrect. So, okay, get, you know, and coming home, get to the airport, try to get my tickets out of the machine and say, no, it's not a valid number. And then go through and no, you got to stand over in this line and talk to a real person. And, you know, I had fortunately I had plenty of time. It, the flight didn't go out till 7. I would have been in deep soup if I tried, you know, tried to cut it close like sometimes I do. So fortunately I had all kinds of time. And another guy was right by me said, man, I really need to get on this flight that's going out right now. I said, okay, go ahead. I mean, and I don't know if he got on that flight or not. I don't think he did. I think they must have put him on a later flight. But finally got up there and said, yeah, you know, last time I missed a flight, I called in. No, it wouldn't have mattered. You know, if you didn't show up for that first flight, second, you know, flight back was gone anyway. But they looked and said, yeah, we've still got a space available on those same flights going home. So that's what I did. Got on the last leg of the flight going home. And as soon as we got in the air, even though the seatbelt signs go on. Saw a guy had me get up, go to the restroom, and thought, you know, okay, one of these entitled guys thinks he can do, you know, ignore the signs or whatever, but, or, you know, maybe not feeling well, got no choice, but got back to the seat and got down, and apparently, flight attendants starting to talk to him, apparently he didn't have any English, which nothing against that. I mean, you got to fly. Then they asked if there were Spanish speakers and they found some people and they found, somebody who was a medical professional and talking to them because they were, you know, got out all the medical equipment and stuff. And I think he may have had, like me, arrhythmia, something similar, a heart thing. And then a guy had actually flown with him next to in the previous flight. He became involved and, apparently being heart doctor, and I guess they were still having some kind of trouble communicating. And I don't know if they do this or not. I mean, I didn't know if they were going to turn us around, take back to the airport. I think by the time they found out what was going on, either past the point of no return or not thinking it was that big of an emergency, might as well take him to the destination, whatever. So not much drama, but a little bit, you know, because they had to come on and take him off the ambulance crew before anybody else get off the plane. But it's not like I was making a connecting flight at that time. That was my last flight, so not a big deal. So, you know, I had some travel glitches along the way, so I just threw all that in one story. Okay, and I've mentioned on PenguinCon, there is stuff for everybody. For some reason, I mean, they still are not, I guess, designed by committee. And it's a little different every year how they post the schedule online, and it's great that they do. But if you go to the link I have in the show notes, you'll see there are different tracks. There's the tech track. There's the food track. There is the talking to authors track. There is, you know, for sci-fi authors, learning how to be, you know, sci-fi author track, sort of gaming track, you know, cosplay track, how to design your costume. And let's see, DIY, do it yourself, life. There's, you know, media was like talking to authors. Lit was kind of how to be an author. Life, a lot of that was, you know, how to prepare for an interview or how to get that job that you want. Cosplay, science, meetups, the burlesque. I didn't attend any of that. I guess that's kind of how you would think. Jokes and people in different states of not dressed. I mean, I don't think anything terribly risque. PenguinCon track at the end, that's sort of the administration track. I usually do a lot of food. Didn't really do it that much this time. Well, you know, most of that stuff that has consumables, you got to be there on the first day and sign up. A lot of times I've done it, you know, just hang around outside the door and people don't show up and they'll let the first few people in. But a couple things, there's a home brew and a Midwestern whiskey tasting thing, and I don't think either one of those came off. The people didn't show up or weren't ready to do it or whatever. So in the food track, those were the main things. I think there's some cheese tasting. I did that last year. But I remember when I first looked at it, there was a lot more stuff in it. Seemed like there was stuff in every block of the tech I really wanted to go to. And the other stuff was, you know, the first, and it's just as well I missed the very first session, 4 p.m. on Friday. My selection would be Open Source Firewall of pfSense with friend of the show Tom Lawrence from the Sunday Morning Linux Review. And, you know, man, normally I would really want to see that. But the other one, you know, Building an Open Source Artificial Pancreas. With Sarah Withy. You know, I guess kind of fortunate I didn't have to make that choice because it's almost impossible. Now I have, since, I looked at Sarah Withy's sites that were linked right after right after I got home. And her slides were up, but there wasn't a video of the talk. There is now, but it's her talk from PyCon. But it's the same topic. I haven't looked at it that yet, but I definitely want to look at that and check out what's involved with building an open source pancreas. Of course, Tom Lawrence, his company, Lawrence Tech or Lawrence Computing, You know, it's got its own YouTube channel, and he's done several things on PFSense. So, you know, if you want to know what he covered in that, you know, just go to the, you know, to his YouTube channel, and you'll be able to find that. You know, next hour after that, 5 p.m., Sunday morning Linux review. Definitely would have gone to that. I ran into Tom a few times. I know Tony was there. I never ran into him. Mary was listed, but pretty sure talking to Hookah that he hadn't seen her. So I think that was just listed, you know, the people making up the schedule, assuming she would be there. I guess Phil and Jay were there. I still haven't met them yet. Still looking forward to that. Like I said, never, Tony was there, never ran into him the whole time. Talked to Tom a couple times. Brian Brodsky, who is not a podcast as far as I know, but is a fan of SMLR and this show and listens to this show. And hey, Brian, we probably hung out more than I did with anybody. Ran into him in several talks and outside the talks and stuff. So, always good to see folks you know, but that definitely there is just so much going on at PenguinCon. It's not like, you know, you need to count on just hanging out with the people you know. You know, next hour you boot for a police party, FOSS on wheels, autonomous cars with open source. Create and install me is fairly basic. Some of these, a lot of stuff I have decried, in the past. A lot of these conferences are going more, enterprise, you know, just, and, you know, there's been enterprise stuff in PenguinCon in the past, but really, if you look at the tech, this year, so much of the stuff, you know, is just the home hobbyist user, you know, would be able to work with. Okay, then we get to the Saturday sessions. Again, I didn't really get there till noon. Modular synthesizers, that would be cool. Vim, I can't say I'm going to really get that interested into it. TDoS, oh, that's probably what I would have gone to, is the 10 a.m. is Tony Bemis's DDoS and what the average person can do about it. I know Tom said his slides were up. Didn't know if that was recorded. It'd probably be something up, and probably just listen to SMLR. You'd be able to get a lot of that. Agile escape room. I was looking at that. I guess you need to know something about Agile really to participate in that. Let's see, the only thing, 11 truths, half truths, sweet lies, reflections of an IT consultant. Definitely, I would have liked to have seen that. 1 o'clock pen testing of Kali. Definitely, would have been up for that. Well, I guess it was probably there for now, but I was still checking in. You know, yeah, that time I was getting something to eat. At the suite where they have consumables and stuff, part of your entry fee is to cover, you know, some small noshes between sessions. I think I described it last time as, yeah, you could make meals off of it if you hit it at the right time. A little more on that later. But yeah, that's why I missed that, because I just got checked in, ran down to see what was left to eat, and actually I was surprised. It was about 1:30, and there was still food there. I mean, there was stuff to cold cuts, and there was a couple bowls of soup, and instead of piling stuff up, I thought, well, 1:30, you know, I can do it leisurely, and I went through and got a bowl of tomato and rice soup, came back, you know, except for a few slices of cheese, all the cold cut stuff was gone. So don't count on, I mean, if you're there and in line, pile on and get your stuff. Or, well, I shouldn't say pile on, but if it's there, take advantage of it, because you can't count on it being there even a few minutes later. Let's see, 2 p.m. women in tech probably is what I would have gone for. I guess, you know, if you're not following off the show notes, the page I'm looking at is penguincon2019.sched.com/overview/type/tech. Let's see. 3 p.m., that's the first one I actually got in. Building your own retro gaming console with RetroPie with Jay LaCroix. So, you know, he pretty much gave the same talk last year.
Was that from a hardware aspect or just the RetroPie software?
Pretty much the hardware aspect, you know, pretty much installing RetroPie, pretty much saying, yeah, you just have to get your image. I think the way he gets his images, he goes out and looks for something specifically and, you know, picks it up off of Reddit. And he said, yeah, you can go to Reddit and, you know, you maybe get 5 links for this game and one of them will still be up, you know, because the companies are chasing them down. Of course, way I've got years ago, I got like a 5 gig, all the, you know, all the images ever, one file. But one thing Jay said that I hadn't realized that is probably why I have not got my RetroPie on right. He said, if you go, what I have is a RetroPie image on top of Noobs. And he says that really, you know, that'll scrape those images and it will get the ones for the old coin-op console games for MAME, but it won't get the, you know, it won't find, if you drop them in, it won't auto-find the files for the, you know, for the old home consoles. And, yeah. So that's probably the problem I've been having. You know, I said, if you want to do RetroPie, get the native RetroPie image and install that rather than going through Noobs or something.
Right. And I wonder if the one that's in Berry Boot natively has the same issue with scraping.
It may. I, the way he talked, it would. And this is something... We talked about the Atomic Pie before the show, and you guys talked about it last week. There is a RetroPie image for the Atomic Pie, but it's on right. Top of it. It's not an image installed and you get RetroPie. It's, you know, you install distribution, then you install RetroPie on top of it.
Right. Right now, I'm playing around with, and it was brought up on the Ubuntu podcast, so I want to make sure to mention that. I'm playing around with Batacera, which is basically a front end, it's like RetroPie, except it's for many different systems, including x86 and x64. So I have it set up on one of my old ThinkPads right now, and I'm going through and testing out games and seeing what works. But they do have images for like the Odroid XU4 and the Raspberry Pis, and they do separate it out. So I guess there's some optimizations there for the 0 and the 2 and the 3. So if you're thinking about building that retro MAME system, Batacera might be something to look closely at.
Yeah, can you drop a link in the show notes?
Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. So, but what I was going to say, I had seen a review of RetroPie on the Atomic Pi, and it came up the same way that Jay said that, you know, the guy was complaining. Well, I dropped all my ROMs in, but it's only seeing the main coin-op ROMs. It's not scraping the console ROMs. So I'm thinking it's the same issue. And so I'm going to be talking about, you know, setting up RetroPie or something, you know, similar on Atomic Pi before we get to the end, I hope. That's probably going to be an issue I have to deal with, you know, either fix that or you know, maybe try something other than RetroPie. But I've been meaning to send this link in, you know, from YouTube to Jay, say, yeah, you know, this is, 'cause I spoke up, you know, during discussion, says, hey, have you ever heard of the Atomic Pi? And he hadn't. And no. And so I filled him in on it. And he's quite interested. But, and one of the games in the demo, I'm trying to think of what it was. It was a console game. Well, I guess it couldn't have been. It must have been a coin-op game. But it's the exact same game that he does in his demo, you know, and contrasting, you know, doing it the same on the Atomic Pi. And the Atomic Pi was, you know, had the same problem. It ran good, but it did not run the frame rate of the native system. So, you know, I've been wanting to send that to him as well, you know. Here's, you know, for what it's worth, here's a way to compare, you know, how the Atomic Pi runs against Raspberry Pi. I mean, the guy who did the Atomic Pi video says, you know, this thing is running all over the Raspberry Pi in emulation, but the one game didn't, you know, seemed about parity between the two. So it may be interesting, you know, emulation software that's big. You know, development has been concentrated on ARM, may have to catch up. But, and definitely the Atomic Pi, I don't think it's as powerful as the upboards, but, you know, by far. But the upboards are like $90 and the Atomic Pi is $35. So, you know, do with that what you will. Okay, and to go hour by hour, but I mean, just want to point out, you know, there was stuff every hour of every day, pretty much, that, you know, I could get behind looking at. Now, 4 o'clock making games for free. Let's see. I guess I must have noped out at 4. Did go to Michael Lucas, is talk at 5. FreeBSD containerization jails. And Michael's the author that I talked about, meeting him here at Kansas Linux Fest a couple years ago. And, you know, figuring we'd passed in the halls a few times at PenguinCon without knowing each other. But, you know, he did several talks, but that was one of them. And Well, that was lucky. Just power just blipped here, but didn't take me down. But you know, it seems like the jails in BSD have been around a lot longer than Docker, and actually are a lot more interesting. He had his book on BSD jail, so I got a copy of that. And of course, Michael also, if you remember, is a fiction author. So they had the hotel had their unused, you know, sort of thing that may have been a coffee shop or a little store before, set up as a bookstore at the end of the lobby. So I also bought one of his fiction books, actually just earlier that day, still carrying around with me, and saw that he was on the schedule. So, went to his talk, missed some of the later ones. And again, up against the Tom Lawrence talk, protecting the digital you. You know, usually you go to these things, and you know, to be one hour to be something you really want to see, and then the next hour, and well, you know, of those, I'll go to that one. You know, and then the this PingCon this year, it's like every hour, you know, at least one thing I really want to see, and sometimes, you know, multiple things, and you can't be in more than one place at once. And this is just in the tech track, you know, forgetting the food track and, you know, the social track and all these other things that are out there. Let's see. I must have gone to try to get something eat about 6 o'clock then, because I would have gone to building a beta-weight combat robot. Don't know why I didn't. And Tech Track seemed to go a little later than usual. There's, you know, end of the evening. Let's see, there's 7 o'clock track. Okay, oh. Yeah, that's when I went to the Adventures in 3D Printing with Ted Preston. And that was really good. And the main thing I took away from there is not what he was wanting me to take away. He did all these really cool things. See, Ted is an engineer with Troy. I don't know if he's working with one of the big three or if he's working with a, you know, consulting company for the big three, but he's definitely involved in the auto industry. And, but, you know, the cool thing was, you know, he takes his work home and he's building stuff to use in his job on his home 3D printer. And he was showing us, you know, man, I've got this cheap piece of junk 3D printer. You know, I don't have this big industrial 3D printer to play with. I'm just like you guys playing junk in the home. But the thing he showed us that I'm taking away that, you know, was just a throwaway thing from the beginning, because of the, you know, I don't think so much for the fire, aspect that some of these 3D printers are not built with as quality components as they possibly could be, trying to get cheap. And, you know, sometimes these things will catch on fire and, you know, you have it in your normal wooden dwelling. You know, is this fire going to go somewhere? So, you know, this is one of the concerns that I've had. And, you know, we've had, if you follow, like, on Podnuts, the Maker Show, they talk about things and they put, like, people have put a plant growing hood around their rig to isolate it. And they put it out in the garage. Of course, mine's an attached garage. So if it catches that on fire, it still catches the house on fire. And I thought about putting it in the concrete safe room. But, you know, Always discussion. Well, yeah, there can be some nasty smells coming out of there, and maybe not wanting that in the house. And Ted, he came up with this brilliant idea. He has this old full size refrigerator that's dead, and he gutted it, and put his 3D printer, which is a lot bigger than mine. You know, I've got like a couple mini 3D printers. He's got like the medium, you know, that you'd assemble yourself or whatever. You know, on a center rack, and then above it, you know, where a rack would be, he's just got a rod going through, and he has, you know, all his filament wheels suspended from that so he can switch them. And then down below, you know, he's got shelving, he's got all the other filament and supplies and parts and all that. And then he's got the whole thing on casters where he can actually roll it out in his driveway and print from there and have absolutely no chance of catching his house on fire or something like that, or having any nasty smells in the house. And he's got he's got a Raspberry Pi connected to the printer and a camera connected to the Raspberry Pi, you know, and string lights inside the whole thing to light, to illuminate it. So, you know, and it's he's got on network. I guess he's got his on wired network. I was thinking, well, you know, just run a Wi-Fi antenna to the outside, put it on Wi-Fi, and then the only connect, you know. And I built this house. It's got outside 220 and 110 connectors on the outside of the garage. So, and you know, all weather type connectors. So really, I'd be completely set up for this. Is just, you know, roll the thing outside in the driveway and plug it in. I'm out in the country. Nobody would care. You know, I sent a letter to Door or emailed to Door and said, yeah, I think this is brilliant. It you know, having a rusty old refrigerator sitting out in your driveway is probably not going to pass a spousal test. Though, you know, it might be better than to burn down the house and have nasty smells inside the house test. So, you know, this was whole not the takeaway that Ted Preston was going for on this talk. But, I mean, he went through a whole bunch of old cool stuff because he was talking about, should have written down the word. Had a word for it, but, you know, in industry, making all these joints where, you know, you make a thing on a hub and an axle and all that, you know, is really not something you can print except in separate parts, and you'd probably want to use metal. But, you know, he was showing all these points where, you know, the pivot point was sort of a honeycomb thing, and so nothing in it bent that far. So you could bend this thing back and forth and back and forth thousands of times and not really stress the joint. You know, you're not where you have a hub and an axle, you're not, you know, and a bearing, you're not where, you know, however you do that, you're still wearing metal off the bearing or whatever. And if you have a single point of pivot, you know, anybody who's had like a plastic box, like a, you know, recipe box, you know, something with a plastic lid that pivots back and forth on a joint. Well, if you keep that for very long, you know, eventually the lid falls off. That, you know, that single point of pivot, you know, starts to tear from the ends and eventually, you know, wears all the way through. Where he was showing all these things, well, you know, this sort of honeycomb structure where no point actually moves that far, you know, and it could go practically forever. So that was a really cool talk. Kind of pause if anybody had a comment at that point at anything. I mean, I'm trying to get through the material, but, you know, stop for a breath at some point where somebody else can jump in. And again, up against that danger and physical risks of 5G networks. You know, we're talking about, you know, we'll get 5G and, you know, it won't matter what kind of, you know, physical landline you have to your house. It'll so much beat it and all that. But we have been hearing some stuff come up. You know, it's not the first time I've heard of, you know, of security risk with 5G networks. So that, you know, that, so somebody's smelling something bad in there, and I wish I could have seen that. And, you know, next to that, the Fediverse, decentralized social networking, and Mike Lucas was in there, and, you know, a few other people that I recognize. Yeah, so definitely, that would have been another one. APM, that was Mike Lucas Ed, the standard Unix text editor. I'm going to have to look at that because that's something I hadn't really heard of. I would like to, but by that time I was, you know, looking for something to eat and a beer. So, and then finally 9 o'clock, and that's kind of unheard of to have the tech go into 9 o'clock. Network science with Network X. So I'm not sure what that is. I probably should have learned. Sunday morning, 9 a.m., RegX. Wasn't quite out of bed. Meant to be. Ben, text to your whim. Always been fascinated with what you do with RegX. Or RegX. It's just... seems kind of dry. Always seemed kind of dry. Hard to get a leg up on. I think once you get started, you know, but it's one of those things, you know, you got to get over that original hurdle. You know, there used to be a podcaster I missed called himself RegX for a while and was really, real good with that. I was always impressed with his skills. Let's see, 10 a.m. Women who gave us gaming. I did get in on that, and a lot of that was touched on Gamergate, the harassment, not just women, but, you know, people who identify non-binary, things like that, you know, and reminding us, you know, he gives a lot of examples in which I should be able to repeat and can't, of people who've made really cool games, you know, not so much mainstream games, but kind of indie experimental stuff. Have to go back to see his show notes because there were some neat things in there. And then there was, Roberta, you know, there's the husband wife team, who gave us the, King's Quest, series of games. And the wife was Roberta and gives King's Quest and Police Quest, I think Space Quest, was it Infocom? No, it wasn't Infocom. Sierra Games. And I was big into those back in the day. And so that was just an example. I mean, it's not like women contributing programming games is a new thing. But, you know, but talking about this whole, you know, just some of the, you know, just the resistance to women in gaming now the vitriol, you know, against women either participating in games or, you know, creating games and, And he talked about things like, well, it's not, doesn't have to necessarily be women, just, you know, you have the fanboys in the game and the game doesn't come out exactly like they wanted, and, you know, getting on forums and.
Well, gaming isn't the only genre where that happens. And granted, you get a lot of the same people in, say, the Star Wars fandom, but you get the exact same crap there. Excuse my language. With people just deciding if it's not exactly the way they wanted it to be, then it must be wrong. So let's tell the world how much we hate them.
Well, you know, and I'm for, you know, I'm not saying that if you don't like something, you should just, you know, not have an opinion or whatever. You know, I am the first one to say, people should be civil in their discourse with each other. However, that shouldn't be a law. You know, you have no right not to be offended. So, you know, I hate to come down on the side of censorship or whatever, but there's a lot of stuff out there that's just uncalled for. Now, I mean, some of this stuff, you mentioned sci-fi, you know, and, you know, like the new Star Trek, and every time there's a new Star Trek, it has to be 25% different because of contractual obligations. Well, you know, if you reboot Star Trek 3 times, that's 100% different, or 4 times. So, you know, where are we going with this? I mean, definitely all the stuff that's been dumped on Discovery, I pretty much back all that. But none of that, I don't think, has to do with, the gender or whatever of who the writers are. It's just, I've seen the first episode of Discovery, and I guess, you know, the whole revamp of the Klingons in the first Star Trek movie, that was the same thing. They had to have the ridges on the forehead, you know, but, you know, then all the Klingons that, you know, with the, even the flawed honor, you know, that like Worf was the epitome because he was the text Klingon, because he didn't grow up living with real Klingons, and, you know, he learned everything about being Klingon from a textbook, kind of, sort of. And then you see through Next Generation and DS9 and all that, you know, interaction with the actual Klingon society, it's not quite as clean cut as the theoretical Klingon honor. And I always liked that, but, you know, now we come to Discovery, and they're eating brains out of skulls, only a generation before. Yeah, I just don't see that. And that is, you know, completely off in left field from what we were all talking about. So I'll drop it there. Let's see. What was... I think I got distracted at 11 a.m. I don't think I saw any of these. E-learning design, network science of Network X, senior sysadmin ethics, team happiness. No, I don't think I got any of those. 12, I know what was happening. I'll throw this in there. The Westin is a convention center. I think, unlike a lot of facilities, the design goes back to the 80s. I didn't realize this year they have 4 elevators going up and down at any one time. Sometimes 2 of them are out of service. I didn't realize that. I just thought they were really slow. But while waiting to check out, you know, because noon was checkout, you know, I went back up to my room to get my stuff because, you know, they're cool. You know, you can take your bag to the concierge and check it in, get it later in the day. It's not like you check out 11 a.m. and then you got to drag your bag around the rest of the day. So, you know, but everybody's trying to get down out of their rooms about that time. And, you know, either nobody will come by going down, it'll be full, or, you know, and then it's a 20-minute wait till the next elevator. And unlike the other facilities, like at Ohio Linux Fest, you know, I guess newer, faster elevators, whatever. And part of it is, you know, I didn't realize. See, I happened to, this is something I mentioned in the notes. While I was waiting for, you know, to go down, I happened to be with one of the major and a couple of the minor organizers of PeguCon, and, you know, and they were discussing things. And I learned a lot. So it was a real good learning experience, even though it was like 90 minutes just to try to check out on my room and getting an elevator down. But, one thing they mentioned, you know, it's like PeguCon is 1,300 people. I think that's got to be three times the size of OLF. At least. So that's part of it. And like I said, older facility, something's not working. In Columbus, it's much newer facility. The elevators are faster. They all work. At South last year, it's not that big a hotel. I think it's only three or four stories tall. You know, the elevators they have are like the hydraulic ram, you know, operated elevators, not the ones who've got the cable to the top. So, you know, not that many people trying to get out of there all at once. LinuxFest Northwest is more distributed. I've been there in the hotel where, most things are run. Once, and then I've been downtown a couple times in other hotels, so everybody's kind of all over the place, so that really wasn't a problem. I'm trying to think wherever else I was, but you know, and I should have included this coming in, you know, came in, wanted to go up to my room, said nope, nobody can, one of the organizers was there, nobody can go up because there was a guy, you know, came in, there's a fire truck and an ambulance sitting there, and it's like, yeah, some guy, and I don't think had anything to do, as far as I know, nothing to do with the conference, but there's somebody upstairs that had a heart attack, and we can't let anybody go up on the elevators until the paramedics bring him down. So all kinds of medical things. And so, well, fine, and I started, well, that's part of the reason I didn't get to conferences, because I didn't go to anything till I went to my room. So I was dragging my big wheelie bag around, and I've got a big one, and bumping into people, but going through all the vendors, you know, that's another thing about PenguinCon, you know, rather than having you don't have the corporate vendor room where they're giving away stuff for free. You do have a bunch of little vendor stalls where they're selling you more more stuff geared to a place where you'd think is a cosplay type venue. But you know, bunch of neat little art type things you can get. There's a place selling a stuffed taxidermy things, little ones and little things you could make at home and all that. So, you know, of course, there's a t-shirt place that makes the, well, I'm wearing the current, the 2019 Penguicon t-shirt. So, bought that there. So it's the big t-shirt thing, bunch of little cool things and jewelry and things to wear and books and stuff like that. So, you know, completely different from any con that you've ever been to. So I was trying to walk through all these crowded places, dragging my big, huge wheelie bag and bashing people's shins and then wondering why is this idiot carrying his luggage around? And that was because, you know, finally run around, saw the ambulance was gone, so figured, well, yeah, it's probably safe to go to my room. Okay. Where was I? Edge X, let's see. Women gave us gaming. Oh, okay, yeah. Sitting there in the elevators waiting to go down. This is probably the last time I'm going to be stupid like that, because since you can put your bags behind the desk, you might as well, when you go down 8 o'clock in the morning, check out then, put your bag behind the desk, and it wouldn't be a hassle. Because the elevators really don't get congested until everybody is trying to check out before 12 o'clock. So, you know, that's a little pro tip for PenguinCon. Just Sunday morning, get up, you know, get dressed, get your stuff, get out of your room then. Another thing I learned is, you know, I talked about last year, well, you know, if you hit it right, your meals are covered on your PenguinCon stuff. Yeah, not so much. I found out that they're really only planning on about a third of the people hitting that meal. And it's not meant to be a full meal. So, you know, even less so this year. I think the first time I said they had soup and sandwich stuff. What'd they have in the evening? Trying to think. I can't remember what they had Saturday evenings. Sunday morning, it was like, you know, quesadillas and cheese sauce or something. And I think they continued that through lunch. And when I tried to go eat lunch, it was all gone. Of course, there's all kinds of other stuff. There's pop. There is hard-boiled eggs, actually in packages. There's packages of nuts, chips. Oatmeal. You know, microwave oatmeal stuff. You know, so there's always something, but really by Sunday afternoon, you know, I was getting like, yeah, I am ready for a real meal. And finally, when there wasn't anything in the lounge, other than snacks, and there's fruit and stuff, you know, bunch of healthy type stuff, juice, coffee, of course, you know. And, of course, there's the ice cream. I only got in the ice cream 2 years ago or, you know, 2 years ago and 3 years ago. They were doing the ice cream 24/7, but, you know, all day long. And last couple years they put in a room and not run all day long. But I did hit some of the ice cream on Sunday when, unfortunately, there's no alcohol in it, but. Did get some good ice cream. The, talked about before, the liquid nitrogen ice cream. There's stuff to eat, but I was ready for a good hearty meal. And it was about 1:30. I went in the restaurant at the hotel and had a hamburger, and that was pretty good. Wasn't that horribly expensive. It wasn't the cheapest hamburger I've ever had either. So, and by that time, You know, really, and not everything that was on the tech track was on the list. A lot of the stuff that I was really interested in and could have done something with. I mean, so I thought about the escape. I was thinking about the escape room earlier, but I found looked like you need to have some kind of working knowledge of Agile. And there's another thing after that, you know, the board game room, and talked about like they were going to teach you to play this board game, but really to go in there, you know, it's essentially, you know, seen this on other conventions, stack of board games, you check them out, and really if you're going to play a board game, you really need to go in there for friends and know the game and be ready, you know, be ready to do it. So I didn't see anything like a tutorial on how to play this game that was on too. So really, you know, afternoon, I kind of was looking for a good, comfortable chair anyway, after walking back and forth across the convention center and across airports all weekend. And, you know, kind of got in the gaming area and found a bunch of people, you know, kind of listened to them play Pokemon Go, you know, on their phones and talking to each other and all that. That's kind of interesting. But not participation. And at 3 o'clock, you had the closing stuff. And I said, a lot of times I might have left, but if I'd known there wasn't that much I was going to do that afternoon, I might have arranged for an earlier flight out. But again, my flight didn't leave till after 7. So, you know, I went through the whole closing stuff, and a lot of it was, you know, recognizing the people who participated. Now, last year they gave away a bunch of door prizes, but I guess they decided against that because I think I talked about last year, you know, they'd call out a name and that person would already be gone, and they'd call out 10 names before they could find anybody who was there in the room. So they didn't do any of that this year, which was good and probably streamlined the whole program quite a bit. So, yeah, I was ready to call for my Uber by that time and get the heck to the airport. And really, if all the hassles I had there, you know, I had about enough time to get a beer before we took off, and that was it. So,
yeah,
you know, at airport prices.
Yeah, I hear the Jupiter Broadcasting guys talking about all the stuff that goes on, you know, after things close down for the day out at a bar or whatever. And it's like, I know I'm not going to be able to do that because I'm not going to go out to a bar out in Irving just so I can try and get home later.
Well, of course, I was there, you know, in the hotel. I guess that's stuff that I didn't talk about. Oh, man, and do I have a story. But, of course, that's part of it, too, is the room parties. And how they're not on the schedule. How you find out about them is they will be listed sometimes in the elevator car and usually at least on first floor, you know, on posters stuck around where you get out of the elevator. A lot of times on all the floors where there's, you know, where there's people from the convention staying. And, you know, these will be the late night events. Don't start till about, well, usually they start about 8, 9 o'clock. And, you know, they will either have, well, of course, the convention itself has beer. And that's one thing to complain about, you know. That whole time, that 90 minutes, I was there with the organizers. They're saying, well, you know, this is Sunday, of course, after all the beer. And said, you know, yeah, we've got 2 kegs of beer left. And it's like, yeah, I guess the organizers get to drink. But, you know, they said last year, you know, we ran out early and everybody complained. And now we got, you know, this year we paid for more and better beer, and we got beer left. And I could see that. And it must have been people siphoning off to the room parties because, you know, usually it would be about 15-minute wait. You'd get your little, you know, little glass of beer, and you go back around to the end of the line. And this year there was no line at all. You know, so you drink your beer, go get another beer, go get another beer. Of course, you had that, you know, one thing they insist is you show them your driver's license every time. And it's like, you know, first you can look at me, tell I'm over 21. Secondly, somewhat. And secondly, you know, you've seen it once and it's like, okay, you got to flash this. And this is the first time they really said that, you know, get somebody in trouble. So, you know, you got to flash us your license. Doesn't mean we have to really look at it. You know, yeah, we know you were just here. So that was kind of cool this year. And anytime there's a consumable, you know, like last year there was history of port or a history of rum or something. And, you know, and whoever's doing that panel will actually provide the consumables, but they do make you show your ID every time you walk through the line. And actually, it's usually that way for the room parties too, just so everybody's covered. But you know what the room parties do is they'll get a room, and all the furniture will be removed. The whole floor will be covered with plastic, so it's like Party by Dexter. And, you know, and then they'll have, you know, whatever, you know, maybe either kegs for beer or, you know, some places will be, you know, just be mixing punch. I was in the, you know, the, Barfleet room for a while, and they just had a couple things, punch, and they would stop and they would pick a number, and the number would correspond to some bottle they had. Okay, well, rum and triple sec, you know, they would just be dumping stuff in. And you know, sometimes it would be a mixer or something when we, you know. So usually if they rolled a mixer, they'd roll another dice and, you know, get something with some alcohol in it. So that was a, there was that. Oh, what was the other one I was in? But they were both pretty good on Saturday night. And there's a tip jar. And I figure I'm going to drink, so I am going to, you know, give generously to the tip jar. You know, and maybe make up for some people who are there bucks down and maybe not contribute. You know, because I've seen people throw a dollar in the tip jar and drink all night, so... I do a little better than that, and you know, keep the thing going. And again, I missed all Friday night. That's that. And if we are looking at, I just went back. If we're looking at our schedule, you'll notice there is the After Dark schedule, and I will go over some of these titles. I will tell you, these titles are not in jest. Consent Expectations. Fun with Floggers. Safe Play and Breath Play. The Wild and Wonderful World of Whips. Fetish and Fluff. The Curious Side of Furry Fandom. Polly and Kink. Demon Lobster, that's actually a podcast. Electroplay. Non-Mongonomy Meetup. Rope Safety and Sadism. Canes, from Sensual to Sadistic. Now, I don't go to these, you know, but I'm telling you, these are no joke topics. That usually start from 7 p.m. and go till later at night. But, you know, I saw a funny topic that I mentioned in the show notes is one of the room parties that they had was something about arcade, you know, so I thought video games. And it said, come sober. And I thought, well, I better go for fairly early in the evening. You know, because there are some of these parties, you know, don't have alcohol. Room parties at night are the people who do not enjoy or don't partake in alcohol, which is fine. And wanting to hang out with like-minded people. So, you know, said come sober. Okay, well, I probably won't be sober later, so I'll go early. Play some video games. So it's clear one in the hall, and I saw the people congregating in front of the door. And these people were all wearing an excessive amount of leather. And I thought, okay, well, maybe the people hosting this are into wearing, you know, into S&M role play while playing video games. So I think about maybe I should turn around and go the other way. But my adventurous, you know, gene kicked in. So let's go walk down there and see what this is about. So I go walking down there. And said, yeah, you know, I'd like to check out the arcade. And they said, you know, and my first thing should have been, well, have you read the disclaimer? I said, disclaimer? No, I had not heard about this. And so they handed me a copy. And it only took about a paragraph for me to figure out their idea of arcade was entirely different from any idea of arcade that I'd ever encountered.
What was it?
I think it might be best described as you are the arcade.
Doesn't sound like my kind of show.
No, I kind of agreed with that. And, you know, I kind of got the impression that maybe expressing a preference with other people that you would like to play with might have been a serious party foul, which, you know, whatever somebody's in, the whole point of this is I am making fun of my own naivety. I am not saying, yeah, these are, you know, I met these freaky peoples. No. It was not what I was expecting from the advertisement. So a good laugh was had by all, and I got the heck out of there.
Yeah, it's a scening. Sobriety and scening are pretty much fundamental.
So, I mean, you know, like I said, you know, PenguinCon is the most fun con that I go to every year. But, I mean, if somebody's so prudish that they say, oh, no, things like that are going on in another room somewhere, you know, at the same place, that is shameful, then this is probably not, you know, if you don't have an open mind about things like that, that is probably not your scene. But I think most of us in open source, we pretty much have open minds. Not saying that, you know, that means you need to participate, but, you know, long as you're cool with other people doing their thing.
Yeah, as long as everybody's consenting adults, then they can do what they want. Just, you know, when I say I don't want to participate, understand that too.
Oh, yeah, and I don't think anybody's going to hang up about that either, you know. You know, if it... I think definitely anybody in that scene is definitely, no, you know, if you've got any qualms at all, then this is probably not the right place. You know, plus, you know, I get the kind of impression these are people who know each other kind of sort of from the local area, and, you know, I'm sure some random guy flying in and just trying to drop in and saying, hey, yeah, let's go for it, you know, is probably not something that makes them comfortable either.
Yes, there is a strict etiquette for this sort of thing. And, yeah, it is, the observer is supposed to be discreet.
And like I said, you know, this, you know, me relating this, it, this was about me and my foibles and, you know, this is not about me saying, hey, I met these strange people. No, you know, these are perfectly normal people and all, you know, I am not trying to sound superior or anything like that. I hope I didn't come off that way. I'm not trying to embarrass anybody. You know, so if somebody who was there happens to be listening, I think, like I said, I think we all had a pretty good laugh about it. Okay, I think that was pretty much covers my PegmaCon. If I think of anything, I'll bring it up in another time. Did have a few more things, but you know, if anybody wants to say, you know, man, it's getting pretty late, maybe we could do this another time. I'm up for that too.
Man, it's getting pretty late.
Okay. If anybody didn't hear, it looks like the Atomic Pie is available again on for order on Amazon. You may not get it right away, but you can order it. So go to the previous show and you find that link. It's the Tom's Hardware, and then the Amazon link off Tom's Hardware. You can order that more comprehensive kit. And I guess we'll hold the rest of these links till next time. That gives us something to talk about in 2 weeks. Okay. Let's see. Sorry, looking something up. Yeah, Texas Linux Fest will have happened by our next show. So Joe and I should be able to speak to that on the next show.
Looks like there's going to be a lot of talks on Kubernetes at that show.
Yeah, like I said, that Texas is one of the ones that, you know, I looked and I haven't ever been there, but it seemed like, you know, there was a lot more stuff on the PagCon schedule than on the Texas Linux Fest schedule. But there, you know, I said there's going to be, you know, kind of a crew of us, at least four, who, not if we haven't met each other in real space, at least know each other some. So to hang out with. So I'm not, I know last OLF, I think I only hit about one or two of the actual talks because we were hanging around. Now, of course, that's probably not a good use of, you know, spending money for the conference and the hotel and the flight and all that, but that's just the way it worked out. And a couple years before, we had done we did a table for multiple podcasts, and I didn't get too many talks on that year either. So, and we're trying to work it out. Yeah, that was one thing I was supposed to announce. We are trying to work that out for Ohio Linux Fest this year. It's mainly me so far, and Lyle and Taj from the Urandom podcast. But we are going to see if we can get a general podcast, Linux podcast table again this year. They put that link in. Is there something specific I was supposed to talk about? Just a second. Let me look here, because I... Oh, okay, yeah. I'll put this link. I don't have this link in the show notes. Taj has created a Etherpad for OLF planning. So I will put that in the show notes. It's taj.dnsdojo.com/9001/p/OLF planning. So, you know, if you're a podcaster or even a podcast enthusiast or listener, and you're coming to OLF and you would like to participate, that is going to be our, where we get together and make plans. Don't know why I don't already have that in the show notes. Okay, it's in the show notes now. Sorry, you random guys. I had one job.
Does that include producing the show?
No, I'm in as far as getting that link in the show notes.
All right, guys, I'm going to have to drop off.
Yeah, I think we're done anyway. Our next recording date will be 7 June 2019. I have been your host, 5150. I've been joined by Honky Magoo.
Good night, all.
And Joe.
Good night.
And Net Miner.
Good night, friends.
Our music is, of course, Downright, which was provided by Klaatu and Brome. We also want to thank Delwyn for the use of his Mumble server. And we want to thank 000 Web Host for our web hosting. Finally, I'd like to give special thanks to Father Finch, Tony Bemis, and for all their help over the years. Thank you, guys.
Good evening, Net Miner.
How do I sound?
A little quiet.
Well, I always have to adjust the audio on this thing.
Now that sounds good.
Well, I always have to adjust the audio on this thing.
So how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing all right.
I put a link to the show notes in the chat. So have you gotten that tablet or the computer from your brother yet?
No, I haven't gotten any of that. No, I've just been looking at the Atomic Pi review. It's an interesting machine.
We talked about that the last show, didn't we?
Yeah, I'm just going back. That's part why I haven't been talking, because I've been watching some of the YouTube videos and I didn't want to get into copyright issues.
Was the review one of 50's links here?
Well, yeah. I drilled down to the hardware review.
Did you finish it, or the video, or did you finish the hardware review?
I haven't, but what's interesting is the fact you can run Android and Linux on it.
A lot of these, except for the Raspberry Pi, you can run Android and Linux on it. Just for whatever reason, I think there has been some builds for Android for the Raspberry Pi, but there hasn't. I don't think it works that well. Actually, that's right. I think I actually tried it out one time, and it was all in some Japanese something that I couldn't, characters I couldn't read, and it was very difficult to trying to get to the point where I could change the language on it to English. And even then, with the Pi that I was using, I didn't have Wi-Fi set up, or Wi-Fi wasn't available. Actually, I think Wi-Fi didn't work on the Android for the Raspberry Pi. And so at that point, it was basically useless. I just had an interface anyways. Yeah, but a lot of it, if you look at the a lot of these single board computers, their list of operating systems usually includes some version of Android.
Well, I'll have to see how Android works. I just have a large screen TV that would be interesting to power up with one of these boxes.
I think just the fact that they have this available to purchase on Amazon was a brilliant move on their part.
Well, I tell you, it's probably going to, it is definitely going to be one of the things that leverages the Pi 4.
You think they can push the Raspberry Pi Foundation to actually put out a more beefier machine?
Well, I don't know about more beefier. But the real thing that causes Pis to be squeezed is that they're a quad-core machine limited to a gigabyte of RAM. Every Pi killer, including the, 3389 stuff, tends to give you at least the option of going to 2 or 4 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, most of the newer machines out, I mean, between the anything from Odroid or Pine, which are the two, the two bigger players in the SBC market, they're all going to something at least 2 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is that I'd like to see what the all-up cost is of this machine. Especially since I've got a 500 gig portable drive here, which would be great running off of this beast. Have you any experience with Android on a desktop?
I have used. I actually brought one to the show about like 3 weeks ago, but that was a respin of Android as a desktop. But there is Android x86. I've tried using that. That was I don't remember why I didn't keep using that. I think the fact of trying to use something that's meant for touch with a mouse or a touchpad gets really annoying really quickly.
Okay, so you're saying without touchscreen capability, the Android gets just, or the Android apps just don't have good keyboard support or whatever.
Yeah, I don't remember what I, how far I actually got with just like trying to run the apps, but even simple things like opening up the screen, not in use, it goes to the lock screen. The lock screen is you have to swipe across the screen. And I couldn't find anything that I could tap on like the keyboard or something. There might have been something that I didn't see, or just trying to open up the lock screen from swiping left to right with the mouse just got really annoying really quickly. And then just regular trying to get around on it was just. Android is meant for touch, and trying to do it with a mouse or a touchpad just it like I said, it got really annoying really quickly, and maybe I just didn't give it a fair shake. The thing I brought up a while back, I'd have to look back and see what the name of it was, but it was Android built to look like a desktop. So in other words, it was more utilized. So the desktop itself was more optimized for keyboard and mouse. The applications, obviously, if you download applications from the Play Store, they're still going to be optimized for touch, which, that's going to be what it's going to be with, depending on the application, I guess. But yeah, I'll have to look at the name of that. That's if that wouldn't be bad to try. Let me find the name. Evening 50.
Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Excellent. I've just been doing my best Bruce Willis impersonation. Okay, since nobody bites, I'll elaborate. Oh, a few months ago, I had a jelly jar not very well balanced in my refrigerator, and it came out and broke on the floor when I opened the door. And I got most of the major pieces, but I've been finding tiny shards here and there every once in a while with my bare feet.
Oh, the second you said the jelly jar crashing on the ground, that's automatically what I went to. That's miserable.
Well, it's not too bad. I mean, you know, the first couple times I found a big chunk that, you know, bled like a stuck pig. But, you know, these little ones are just annoying.
Right, but sometimes those little ones can just get themselves lodged in there.
Yeah, I must have sensitive feet. I tend to jerk back enough where I don't just bury the thing clear in my foot.
No matter. The Android desktop that I was talking about was called Prime OS.
Okay, yeah, that's one of the ones tested on the Atomic Pi. The thing that I'm wondering about is, you know, what's the all-up cost of the Atomic Pi? I mean, it seems like it's more capable than a Raspberry Pi or Raspberry Pi class machine, but I wonder what a case and power supply and that sort of thing is going to cost for it.
Well, I may be wrong, but this link that 50 put, the Amazon link that 50 put in the show notes here, is Atomic Pi high-speed SBC with the peripherals. And the peripherals include, it doesn't necessarily look like a case, but it's definitely a power supply. It's what, the baby breakout board, 2.5mm power supply, jack only, the standard breakout board with the screw terminals and PC-style Molex socket, a 5-volt, 2.5 amp, 2.5mm switching adapter, 5-volt, 3-amp, 15-volt industrial supply means well 2-40C. I'm not sure what that is. And there's two other things that look like, was it industrial open frame power supply? So it seems like it comes with the power supply stuff. A case, I'm not sure.
I know the base unit with nothing is, the SBC itself is $35. I don't know if I was able to, since it was out of stock, if I was able to price that link where it had, you know, the full set of peripherals. I know like the daughter board or whatever gives you maybe a couple extra connectors. I have to go back and look, see exactly what that does. I think power supply would be comparable in price to a Raspberry Pi power supply. Now, the weird thing about the Atomic Pi is that, at least by default, it charges through two pins on the I.O. And I think, you know, the basic thing is there's an adapter to a barrel connector, and then you have a wall wart with a barrel connector on the end. I think maybe one of the things that the daughter board does add is a barrel connector. So just for, and as far as cases, I don't think there's anything out there yet.
Yeah, I think that the baby breakout board is the one that has the barrel connector to it, and then it has the power supply to it. And so the link you put in there has, like I said, it's the version with these peripherals. And it says it doesn't have a like a buy me link, I don't think, unless you, hold on, see all buying options. But it says here in the corner, new is $49.99, but it's also plus $15.39 for shipping.
So actually, I think it would compare fairly favorably with the Raspberry Pi. I mean, you add in a little bit more for that daughter board or the breakout board, and I think you're right there.
Well, the one thing about a Raspberry Pi, though, and this maybe just be like me, but I have so many micro SD cords and, you know, plugs around that the amount of money it would take me to get a Raspberry Pi up and running is a lot less than it would take for this. Because, I mean, I have so many basically power supplies for it sitting around, and then it's just an SD card, and if I need to hook up a keyboard and mouse, or if I'm just going to put it as a headless server.
Yeah, on these, though, I hate to grab just a random power supply, because you want to make sure you've got at least 2.5 volts and, you know, just a random charger, generic, you're not sure what it is. Maybe for some of the latest phones, but then they're not going to have a barrel, you know, they're not going to have the right connector, probably.
Oh, for the Atomic Pi, I would absolutely buy whatever they have here. I would probably get this pack with the breakout board and the barrel connectors and stuff. I would feel a hell of a lot more comfortable with that. But I'm just talking about the difference between getting ready, you know, out of the box, you know, not having to buy extra stuff for it. This seems to be like you have to do a little bit more than just your regular, like, Raspberry Pi and even some other single board computers.
And I'll talk about it more in the show. I do have an application for it right away. And I'll mention it again when we get to the show, but I couldn't replicate it. But I was able to bring up one page on Amazon that said the Atomic Pi will be available again on the 30th.
So the link you put in the show notes, I clicked the button for see all buying options, and again it just spelled out the price of being $49.99 with $15.39 shipping, and then it says it arrives between May 23rd to the 29th. It ships from Florida.
Oh, okay. So there's an option to buy now already.
Yeah, it appears.
Yeah, we'll have to do that right after the show then.
I'd like to see what the full-size breakout board does. And it is the Molex connector designed so that you can put it in a regular PC?
I don't know.
You see, I can't tell whether the Molex connector is designed to help you power an external device or if it's designed so that you can put it inside a PC case and run it as a slave to a regular PC.
Yes, I'm looking at the Tom's Hardware article, and you may have to post what you're looking at on Amazon, Honky. I'm not seeing it in the article I posted last week, or last time. Tom's says the base version includes a board and is $34. The next model up for $39 includes support for the 2.5 millimeter PSU, so I assume that's one of the breakout boards, and another offers a large breakout board with screw terminals for $49. I guess that's $49 altogether. Okay, that wouldn't be too bad. Full developer's kit, including cameras, a power supply, and two Atomic Pi boards for $95. I wish there was one in between that had all that for just the one board. Or 24 single board computers for $6.96. So I think you probably want to play for one before you go $700.
Check out the
link. Never mind. I see the Amazon link.
I was going to say, check out the link that you put in tonight's show notes.
Yeah, you're right. I see it right here. Add to cart, which I've just done. Yeah, I've been trying to get to Wichita to go see Endgame in the 2 weeks since I got back from Detroit. Felt a little kind of silly. I don't regret it because I used a chance to partake in a little Cajun food at a little restaurant I found, but which was nice. Had some gator, which I've never had before, but drove all the way up there to see Endgame, and then came back last night and looked at, and I hadn't looked at what was on locally, and it's Endgame's in my local theater this weekend.
Now, did you see Ms. Marvel?
Which one?
Captain Marvel?
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's necessary to see before seeing Endgame, but or anything, probably anything is. I guess if you'd never seen Marvel before, you could go in and enjoy Endgame, though you might be a little lost. But yeah. It's kind they had to do Captain Marvel to use her in Endgame.
Would you enjoy them?
I really enjoyed Endgame. Captain Marvel was okay. I put somewhere in the in the middles. Endgame was incredible. I won't say much more about it than that. It's just that those two movies kind of suffer from, you know, the same thing as Justice League. You know that, you know, oh, we're against insurmountable odds. Let's wake up Superman. And then all of a sudden you get Superman, and then it becomes really easy, hardly an inconvenience, to defeat the bad guys. And what, you know, kind of like that at the end of Captain Marvel when she gets full power, and definitely Endgame. You know, they probably had enough stuff on the ground, but definitely that, you know, suddenly turns the tide. So, you know, it's kind of hard to write when you've got a character. Oh, yeah, once this character is here, the movie's over. I mean, that's just sloppy writing on my part, because, you know, comic books were never like that. You know, you usually, at least I never saw one like that. You know, animated movies, it's not like, yeah, Superman solves everything.
Which still kind of baffles me, because Superman is just generally indestructible.
Yeah, and Captain Marvel, it kind of makes everything moot when you have somebody can fly through spaceships.
Yep. Yeah, I haven't seen either one yet, but from what I've been told, Endgame is just really good.
Yeah, it's just, well, you see, that's how long, because there really is callbacks to all the movies. All the characters are either in there as, well, some time travel, and you revisit scenes in movies, and it's either, you know, the old scenes, or they bring the characters back and reshoot the scenes slightly a different way. So I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say, literally, you know, anyone you ever saw in a Marvel movie is back.
Now, I lost the article that I had on it, but did you hear that... So when Disney purchased Fox, part of what they purchased was a percentage holding in Hulu. And apparently Disney is now buying off Comcast out of Hulu and is leaving an option for Universal to... I think over the next 3 years, to buy out Universal as well, something along those lines. And they want to use, if my understanding, Disney wants to use Hulu to promote more of their, not kid or animated movie content. Whatever. What is the regular? Motion picture company that Disney owns.
Well, they own Marvel.
Well, that buying Hulu seems to make more sense than setting up your own streaming service.
Well, I think they're going to do this alongside the other streaming service, but the other streaming service is going to be geared more towards more towards like their Marvel, Star Wars, and, you know, like, their animated movies and, you know, the animated shows and stuff like that.
Well, I am glad to see that I have not seen anything else with WB buying DC Comics that they're going to kill the DC streaming service. I mean, it looks like everything... full steam ahead. You know, they're still talking about Swamp Thing next, and then Stargirl after that, I guess. And I don't know if they've been filmed. Surely they probably started filming Stargirl, but you know, I would think if they were going to start cutting back, looking to take it down, that, you know, they would say, okay, no, we're not doing this one. We're going to play out what's in the can. So. Hopefully the YouTuber that I follow, it's something about that, you know, that DC is doomed. It is completely 180 degrees wrong.
You're really enjoying that DC streaming service, huh?
Well, really, those are my favorite shows. Of course, there's only one at once. I need to go back and watch a lot of the animated stuff, but movies, and occasionally the. I don't think these latest couple Batman animated ones are going to like drop there first. Gotham by Gaslight dropped, on the streaming service the same day, I think, as it was available to buy. So, but maybe they're not going to do that again for get their money out of some of these things first before they drop them on the streaming service. But, as far as the quality of the shows, I really can't complain, especially Doom Patrol. Only one of those left after the one tonight, which I haven't seen yet. So, keep my fingers crossed we get another season.
So I found, I should probably drop a link to this. It is a big old graph of everything that Disney owns. But Disney's just regular movie company is called the Buena Vista. And then basically anything that's owned by ABC. So they also own Lifetime, History Channel, A&E, FYI. They also own ESPN. They're going to set up their own another separate streaming service just for all their ESPN content. They do have ownership of everything. 20th Century Fox and FX related as well, and Fox Sports. So I'd imagine part of that would be, they'd use Hulu for any of their ABC shows, any of their movies, their Buena Vista movies. I wonder if they would leverage that for History Channel, Lifetime, A&E, and all that stuff, as well as if they have controlling issue with Fox, any of the Fox shows.
Well, there are some of the History Channel original series already on Hulu. I think Black Sails was a History Channel, maybe not, but I know Vikings was, and it's on Hulu, albeit I think a season behind, just like when some stuff shows up on Netflix, it goes up a season behind. I don't know. If I were their lawyers, I would be awful afraid if somebody in Congress start yelling, monopoly or whatever, and try to get them broken up. Now, I've heard of people yell monopoly at Amazon, but I mean, where are you going to get your stuff? You're going to tell Amazon you have to just go back to buying books there? And then break electronics into another website. I guess it could be done, but I mean, no way you could do it as efficiently. And, people said, well, nobody can compete. Well, yeah, I guess that's the way things work. But, definitely all of these properties going in and consolidating, essentially three companies. You're going to have the, Netflix, Disney, and whatever else being on Amazon Prime, and not being a whole lot less else left out there. So if I was them, I would be a little bit more picky, saying, yeah, I want that, and I want that, I want that. Of course, I see why they grabbed Fox, is so they can, eventually try to put all the Marvel stuff together under one banner. But of course, to do that, you're going to have to get rid of, you're going to have to reboot X-Men and Fantastic Four entirely.
Well, with the purchase of Fox, and just from looking at this chart, kind of clued me into it too, is they now have a very large controlling, if almost a monopoly of basically televised sports. Because if they own ESPN and Fox Sports, those are the major people. who else is there? If they want to, if anyone wants to call Monopoly on anything, I think that's one thing that somebody should call Monopoly on.
Here's something from left field. Amazon is expanding into shipping and air freight.
Are you talking about the, they actually came out with a couple of the drones?
Well, they have a delivery drone, which doesn't fly. I mean, a delivery robot. But no, they're actually doing a FedEx where they are buying cargo aircraft.
And that doesn't surprise me at all. I know two people who drive for Amazon. So I have one friend who lives near an Amazon warehouse, and he goes there, and with his car, he'll go there and load up a bunch of Amazon deliveries directly from the warehouse and go deliver to people's houses. I have another friend who on Sundays goes to his local USPS, and he has like a little lockbox, and when he opens that up, he gets a key to an actual USPS truck, and then he uses the USPS truck that already has all of the packages loaded into it and the route already mapped out, and he goes and delivers it then.
So is this like Uberization of package delivery then?
So the one my friend does with when he uses his vehicle, yeah, that's basically the Uberization of it. The other one seems to be I'm not sure whether it's just because of the fact that they have some sort of a deal with the USPS because they won't run on Sundays. But if you look out and see a USPS truck out delivering, more than likely they're on a Sunday. More than likely they're just delivering Amazon packages.
Well, the interesting thing that I'm hearing is that Amazon shipping is going to be completely IO. Right now, Amazon shipping is essentially delivery / pickup service, but for Amazon customers. Amazon is going to be opening their shipping to general access.
So basically they want to take over they want to take over the USPS, but the USPS is a government run operation. From what my understanding, a very poorly run government operation, but a government run operation all the same. They want to be the next FedEx or UPS, because that way, if they control the shipping, then they have complete control over every aspect of their business at that point.
Well, yeah, it always makes
no, but it no that what they're talking about is that they're going balance the costs of setting up their shipping network by allowing the public to subsidize it.
Hey, Joe, I can see that, but essentially they do want to be like you said, they do want to be like the new FedEx or UPS, right?
I got to tell you that the Postal Service is going to be letters only before too long.
Yeah, but it's
you're talking about. Sorry, I just want to inject here real quickly, Honky. You talked about how it seems like the post office is not really well run, and I don't know if they're private contractors or whatever. But a couple trucks running around here, old box trucks, you know, obviously old former. You know, 30-year-old Ryder trucks with the paint peeling or been painted over or whatever. And if you look on the back, there's this little stencil, you know, U.S. Post Office. And you're thinking, well, you know, if that was an actual government truck, surely they would make it look a little better than that. You know, so I'm sure it's private contractors hauling the mail for the government. But, you know, they're not... They're not obviously not interested in people keeping their equipment looking spiffy.
But from my understanding, that's the way. Like the USPS does not care about their vehicles at all. From my understanding, they just basically run these things absolutely into the ground. And they have absolutely no desire to fix this, fix them at all. I was talking with a friend of mine, and we were talking about the fact that if there was ever a really, really good use case for electric cars, it's a postal vehicle. You imagine you're not going that far away. You're not using that much energy. It's the same, you know, all you have to do is set up the bunch of charging banks at the USPS station. I mean, you're never going to run out because you're not going that far away. But that would be, but that would make sense for, if you ever wanted a use case for electric cars, it's going to be something like the USPS. But the USPS seems to be dying out to the point that, and I don't think anybody seems to care about it. Actually, I think the USPS for some packages, if not all packages, have actually turned to the UPS system.
Well, you actually around. I know that at, I thought I saw a FedEx box at the post office,
and I don't think I made note of the link anywhere, but. Saw something, I think it was out in California, legislatures again were trying to, you know, bounce around an idea for a tax on text and stuff.
Well, like a data tax type of a deal?
Yeah, I guess because, you know, oh no, our post office is dying. We have to have another source of revenue, so we'll charge you 50 cents for a text.
They already had that. It was back in the probably earlier, well... Even up to I'm sure you can still find some cell plans where, you know, they'll charge you for text. I want to say that most of them now have went to a limited text just because of the complete lack of data that, you know, that actually takes to send a text.
Right, but I mean, this is just more clueless politicians thinking they can, you know, throw a tax on traffic across the internet and it'll be tolerated.
Right. Yeah, I feel like that the government has just basically given up on the USPS. Other things came along and started, you know, doing a lot better than they were, and, you know, no one's sending letters as much as they used to. It's all pretty much packages, and so I feel like they just gave up. That was it. So I think if someone like Amazon wants to create their own shipping company, God bless them, go for it. At this point, they're just going to be competing with probably UPS and FedEx. I see a lot more UPS than I do FedEx.
Well, I have a service that the post office could provide me.
P.O. Box?
Oh, God, no. Those are overpriced. And I got so much stuff that wasn't to my post office boxes when I used to rent one. At two different post offices, that was just, it was insane. No, what I want as a service is a do not junk mail.
Yeah, I want that on my phone first.
Right? I tell you, the last couple of days of...
No. What I'm saying is, here's a win-win for the post office. The post office can collect from the junk mail companies for sending junk mail, and then they can charge the consumer for an opt-out of junk mail.
Yeah, but I tell you what, Netminer, I bet junk mail is the bread and butter of the post office. If it was just you and me sending letters to each other, they'd have been out of business 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's the bulk of what they do, so I imagine it does make them the most money.
And one thing I will say for the USPS, you know, if the government said, okay, we're going to pull out of this, we're going to make it all private enterprise, you're not going to be able to send a letter by FedEx or UPS for 30 cents, which might be a good thing. You know, that might finally push some sort of legal standard, you know, for electronic delivery, and verification that you got it and you saw it or whatever, you know, for legal issues. You know, you can't send somebody an email for legal issue and say, yes, you've been summoned or whatever, or this is the, you know, you've been duly notified, that you owe this, unless you opt in, you know, and you say, yeah, I want electronic, bill notifications. But that should be something the government is working on that they've completely dropped the ball on.
One of the things that happens if you go that way, it will mean basically that there's got to be a basic data plan with your phone service. It will mean that there's a universal access that actually works. Although how this would work out in the boonies where, well, a lot of my relatives lived.
Yeah, looks like Honky's having the same trouble I have occasionally. You go type and some mystery phantom puts the cursor on the wrong line for you.
Yeah, you know, sometimes that mystery phantom is called my thumb.
You don't have the keyboard set to turn off automatically?
No, I should.
What is it? Syndaemon space -D? Turn off the touchpad automatically when you're typing? Yeah, sorry I was late tonight, guys. I wasn't feeling real well.
That's fine.
Oh, no problem. I think we might have been beginning to wonder if you were coming or not, but...
Well, guys, we haven't started the show yet, so he's not late.
No, not at all. Especially not by our standards. Joe, did you catch in the IRC during Tilts that Mordensey is coming to Texas Linux Fest?
No, Mordenson. Who's that?
Mordensey. Neil, I have to go look up his email. Before your time with Tilts, he's really cool guy. You'll enjoy meeting him. But you know, he does, you know, stuff like making t-shirts and pins and stuff, and he's done that for Tilts in the past.
Oh, cool. Yeah, we'll have to figure something out. You said that we were going to use a service to get everybody talking together.
Yeah, Voxer on Android. That seems to be. I'll see if I can't get that set up in the next week and add everybody in that way. You know,
use WhatsApp or Discord, because I'm getting tired of adding more messaging apps. I really am.
Well, we can look at that. You know, see what maybe get together on email. I've got everybody's email, and you know, if we want to decide on something different, we can do that too.
Okay.
It's just a cool way, you know, if we're all spread out around. Yeah, we're going to get together for lunch here or whatever. Okay, since there's a lull, there's a couple things I wanted to throw into the pre-show. And yes, those of you out there who are completely against on Linux content, this has nothing to do with open source. A couple things I found on YouTube. And last week I found a channel called Clockwork Towers. And what they do is they take old Twilight Zone episodes and they just edit them down to just, just what needs to be there to keep the story going. And they can usually edit them down to, you know, between 7 and 12 minutes. So you really get the effect of the whole episode in less than half the time. So I've been going back and rewatching old Twilight Zone episodes that way. Some of them I've seen, some of them I haven't, but I've really enjoyed it. And another thing I've mentioned before is an anthology sci-fi series on YouTube called Dust. And what gets me is, you know, Dust will usually have some actors, you know, maybe not name actors, but actors you recognize, character actors. Sometimes, you know, a lot of times people you've never seen before, but, you know, every three or four episodes, somebody you have. And but all our popular TV shows, you know, that have been high rated and all that, you know, they say, yeah, but it just costs too much per minute to make this sci-fi show where we can make reality TV for nothing or make a sitcom for nothing. You know, as far as acts, and it's just, even though this is the second most popular show on TV, we just can't afford it. And Dust, which we're seeing for free, you know, per minute, a lot of times has just as involved and spectacular FX as anything on TV. And without, you know, I guess they got backing somewhere from Hollywood or something. Somebody must be backing them. But, you know, I think it's worth a discussion sometime on where this money is coming from and why we can't get these quality TV shows because they, quote, cost just too much to produce. And we're getting just as quality for per minute for free on YouTube.
So is Dust just basically a bunch of short films?
Yeah, probably just little sci-fi stories that they picked up or whatever. But yeah, some, usually around 10 minutes.
That reminds me, I haven't looked into it very much, but a guy whose videos I like made a movie very recently, a combat veteran. He made Hell California. He released that on YouTube. Let me check real quick.
What was it called?
Hell California from a combat veteran. Are they still filming? Yeah, looks like they finished filming for Hell California, but he hasn't released it yet.
One of the things I found interesting is that YouTube has some free movies that are, well, they're somewhat older, but...
Yeah, they used to have, what was it, all the old Miramax films?
Yeah, and they have been putting stuff on there on purpose. I mean, they've got the one tier. Well, I mean, you can get, like, you know, stuff that's coming out on Amazon Prime at the same time almost on YouTube. And you pay at least, you know, probably a little more on YouTube for it. Or Netflix, you know, or stuff that's coming out on Netflix or whatever. So you can get, like, first... Well, I won't say first run. Stuff was just out of the theaters. You got that. And for a while, you had a bunch of your old black and white movies on there just pirated and probably nobody cared. And then for you, you know, you'd have stuff on there, be on there for a while, and then there'd be a takedown notice. It would be gone when you go look at it. And there's others that was just a fake out. You know, it would say... watch this movie, right. You click on it, and it's just a loop. Go to our pirate website and watch exactly. It here.
Yeah. No, and sometimes you could pick up older TV shows on the free YouTube and they'd be there, and or foreign countries TV shows, like some of the Irish shows. What was that one? Mrs. Brown's Boys. You could watch full episodes of that for a while, and I guess they'd get takedown notices. But that reminds me, like, day before yesterday, I was looking for this specific TV show from the 80s called Parker Lewis Can't Lose, and I can't find it really anywhere except for one episode on YouTube, and I think that's the pilot.
And but no, YouTube itself has been putting up, you know, I think because they weren't getting the traffic on the paid stuff, I think it's promotion, you know, a little bit older movies, 4 or 5 year old movies, throwing them up there for free. Not everything, of course, but yeah, you'll go through and you'll get promoted a legit link to a movie that YouTube has put up there for free that's not ancient. And then there's a few things out there. They will run stuff for a while. Like there's a Stargate channel that will run, you know, and I think it's the legit Stargate channel, but they will run 3 or 4 Stargate episodes at once. And then they're kind of moving through it, you know, so it's not like first episode just sits there forever. You know, you'd have to catch it and watch it like a series.
Oh, like Crackle used to do.
Yeah, and I've got the Crackle app. I hardly ever take advantage of it, but there is a lot of stuff on there too. I mean, there is a lot of legit content out there for free.
I know Crackle used to rotate Married with Children seasons.
And another one I think I mentioned on here is the legit. Pretty sure it's legit because they got so much stuff. And I can't think of it, but it's the channel for the old animated Marvel series, like the X-Men and Spider-Man and stuff like that. And most of that stuff's out there all the time too.
Probably not for much longer. Wouldn't that get pulled into Disney streaming's
Yeah,
service that's coming
I
up?
imagine once Disney's up, they'll pull all that.
Yeah.
And hopefully, if you got Disney, it will be like DC. You know, the stuff will be out. You know, if you're paying for it, then it's going to be out there
Right, the whole back
all the time
catalog.
forever. Yeah.
Yeah, that might make Disney streaming worth it, sadly.
And if you got kids, or you know, you just like the old Disney movies or stuff, you know, it would be nice if they, you know, back when we were kids or what or whatever on the you know, when video first came out, you know, say, yeah, get it now or it goes back in the vault forever. And I'd like to see some of the old live action Disney stuff out there that you just don't see. Like well, I think I saw Bedknobs and Broomsticks on had to pay for it on Prime here a few months ago. There, you know, there's a bunch of stuff out there you don't think of being as a Disney movie. If you go back and look, yeah, that was a Disney movie.
Well, anymore, you just have to assume that Disney owns it no matter what it is. I mean, they've bought up almost everybody.
I mean, what I want, well, you know, I bought a bunch of movies for my dad. You know, pretty much all the John Wayne stuff. Trouble is, the John Wayne stuff is cheap, you know, to buy on Amazon. Those are usually only 4 or 5 bucks. It's when you get into the other westerns, your Audie Murphy or your Jimmy Stewart and all that, you know, some of those
Really?
15, 20 bucks.
So the older ones are even more expensive? Because Audie
Oh,
Murphy
yeah.
would have been before John Wayne.
No, Audie Murphy would have been. Audie Murphy was the most decorated soldier of World War II, so he
Oh,
and he,
right. Okay. So towards the end of John Wayne, but also less, was he less popular?
oh yeah, it would have, you know, it would have been like the 50s. I mean, he made probably 30 westerns of some kind back in the 50s and early 60s, but
Right.
you know, not didn't have his start as early as John Wayne, and certainly didn't last nearly as long.
Right.
I was just using him for example. I mean, you got Randolph Scott, you know, Roger Mitchum, you know, all those old guys. But the, you know, most, it's surprising the most popular ones, the John Wayne movies, are really that if you go out to Amazon and you start buying them up individually, the John Wayne stuff is the cheapest stuff out there because they're probably making the most copies of it. But
Right.
I mean, I wish. Now, of course, you go back to the 30s, you know, Hopalong Cassidy or whatever. I don't know if he even Hopalong, but you know, the old serials and stuff where they were before they really got serious with Western movies. Yeah, all that stuff's out there on archive.org. But I really wish there was, you know, a streaming channel I could go to and just sit down and watch an old Western movie or an old war movie or something.
Yeah, I didn't
I
think
guess
about them being on archive.org. When, you know, I like archive.org. I just have to wonder about the legality of it sometimes.
well, unless there's some extra encumbrance, usually right now about anything before 1940 is public domain. I mean, there's a couple John Wayne movies out there that you always see. Well, I mean, you get one of these things in Walmart, you know, a really cheap one, and it's all those old movies he did in the 30s. And then there'll always be two. There will
Oh,
be.
when he was on his military kick, or one of his military kicks. Was there
not really? There wasn't any war movies till really during and after the war. But you know, the little 30-minute shorts, you know, where he was competing with Gene Autry and things like that, things you would never remember. But you know, you can get $5. You can get a disc of all those on there. And there will always be a couple because they somehow screwed up the rights and they've gotten the public domain is Angel and the Bad Man. And I think it's McClintock. Both.
You see a lot of McClintock floating around and you see a lot of Big Jake. But I don't know if that's because of the licensing or not on those.
Well, Big Jake, I don't think is public domain, but I'm pretty sure it's McClintock is the one it is. But
it does play a lot on it used to play a lot on TV. I don't watch enough TV anymore to tell you.
Well, see, that's it. Growing up, you would see the John Wayne movies, but when the cable companies came out, they bought up the rights to everything. You just don't see the old movies on Saturday afternoon like you used to.
Right.
So these kids growing up, they haven't seen these. I mean, in my opinion, you know, the majority, you know, there are more good movies made before 1970 than after.
I enjoy CGI.
Well, that's true. I mean, sci-fi and whatever. You could probably count on one hand the great sci-fi movies made before 1970.
Yeah. I can't think of any.
Forbidden Planet.
See, the problem is I didn't go through that era of movies, so.
Well, if you ever get a chance to see that, you need to see it, because if you look at it, you can see, you know, Trek borrowed very heavily from that movie.
Right.
And really, a lot of the sci-fi movies since.
Yeah, I mean, I could name TV shows from that era. Doctor Who started in 1963, or no, was it 62? Because it started the year before Star Trek started, you know, on broadcast. So, but movie wise, I can't think of anything from that genre in the 70s. I know that they were there, but I can't think of anything that sticks out in my head.
Well, I mean, there were the monster, you know, of the week type. You know, you had those serials back in the, well, from the 40s and the 50s. And
right.
You may have had a few things like The Blob and The Thing from the 60s.
Yeah, but that's more horror genre than sci-fi genre. I can name some probably early horror genre films. Carnival of the Dead. No, Carnival of Souls. That's the one.
Yeah, sorry, folks. Talking made my cough come back. I had to go run, get some cough medicine.
But post-1970s, what, that's really when CGI started coming to the big screen, and what, The Last Starfighter?
Well, actually, The Last Starfighter was the first movie to use CGI, and they did it all on a Cray.
Right, and it's awesome. And then, well, it's still post-1970, so, and then Tron, the original Tron movie.
Yeah, the one thing I didn't like about The Last Starfighter is the whole Deus Ex machine at the end. Yeah, hit one button and shoot all directions at once and take out the enemy fleet. Well, if you do that, why didn't you do it in the first place?
It was a prototype. I didn't know if it actually would work or not. But yeah, I get what you're saying with that one.
And the kid wasn't pilot. He was just the gunner. But no, other than that, I really enjoyed that movie. I'm trying to think of a YouTube video I saw the other day. Something recent that they actually said, now we want to go back and do the whole thing in practical, or most of it. And I can't remember what it was.
Do the whole thing in what?
Practical effect, rather than CGI. Okay. In other words, they built models for everything.
Are we going to start the show tonight?
Yeah, I think it's probably... I'm sorry, we've been going off at a tangent. Probably my turn to host. Anybody else have anything they want to get in before we start?
Not going into the notes. No, go ahead.
Okay, well,
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
Oh my God, it's Hacker Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Flying Rich, he's a bloody drunk.
If you don't like the gas, you can get up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll get back.